Senior Focus. Good afternoon, everyone. Kia ora tātou. I'm Anne-Marie Khoury. I'm your presenter for this edition of Senior Focus. And this week, lots of voices are being heard about we have got a leadership gap at the top of our country. We have got multiple crises occurring week after week, and they're not unrelated, whether they're the economy, climate change, issues around education changes and upheavals. It just goes on and on. And questions coming to me from many older people, look, we need a new way to look at things. We need to be looking more long term. We need to take account of investing in things that we want to have happening to change the outcomes we're getting. And when I hear this conversation, I immediately think, well, there are people actually doing some very interesting reports. There are people actually gathering ideas, and they've got answers, and I think we need to hear from them. So I have today with us online Gareth Hughes, who's the director of the Wellbeing... can you fill me in on this, please?
Yeah, so I'm the director of the Wellbeing Economy Alliance. We call ourselves We All because we're trying to find those solutions that work for everyone. Too much of our current system is all about I. We're looking out for me. We're looking out for we. We're part of a global network with hubs in 19 countries. We're a charitable trust. I describe our work as a think tank and a do tank. We do research. We do reports. We're also actively pushing for a few big ideas like intergenerational fairness and long-term thinking.
And thinking about intergenerational, I mean, 17% of New Zealanders currently believe that the next generation will not be better off than the generation that's passed. And that's not a good sign. I think what you're on about makes a great deal of sense. But before we unpack all this, the We All, or Wheel, is very catchy, and I got stumped on the what the E and the A stood for, but I do know that Alliance is part of it, so I'm halfway there. The thing is that what I understand about the model is that in the past, economy has been termed, you know, what's happening with the GDP. That's our measure of success, and yet that success measure doesn't measure outcomes of like social impact or negative outcomes or costly long-term consequences for some decisions that look good on paper in the short term. So thinking about vape sales and car crashes and thinking about all sorts of things that have negative in value but are perhaps increasing, they're not a measure of success. So can you articulate how your organisation's view of the economy and how it should be measured is moving away from GDP?
Well, I often joke the economy is too important to leave to the economists, but it's economists like Marilyn Waring in New Zealand who have been international leaders questioning this relentless, I think, myopic focus on gross domestic product as the main measure of the success of a country and success in society. It can lead to all sorts of perverse outcomes when you just measure the overall throughput rather than the actual quality of that economic development. Again, this isn't an old idea. Even the inventor of gross domestic product, the economist Simon Kuznets, warned that it was an inadequate measure of progress. Originally, it was developed during the Second World War as a way that countries could count the amount of tanks and bombers and guns they were producing, and then afterwards how they would pay for a future war. So, in a way, it's been a success. Every country in the world measures the same things the same ways. The problem is that we're measuring perhaps the wrong things the wrong ways and considering that progress. Right now, the United Nations is doing a review into GDP and coming up with alternate measures of progress. And this is one of our challenges to all political parties in New Zealand. Just going for growth is no answer that we're going to see better outcomes in our society. If you just count the amount of guns or vape stores that are opening, that's not a very good measure of whether we're actually healthier, happier, or even richer. When you look at the child poverty statistics in New Zealand, between 1984 and 2014, our economy was 75% larger. But what happened to the numbers of children growing up in child poverty or material hardship? It doubled. It grew by 50%. So the fact of an economy growing is no guarantee that we're going to see actually kids with better opportunities for the future or a cleaner environment. So that's one of the central arguments we make is, well, let's actually develop better measures of progress and make sure when we talk about economic growth, it's actually growing the goods and not the bads.
Yes, and on that score, we need to look at the structures of how things are delivered. And when we look at the state of public assets, it's been quite popular to sell off the silver, sell public assets to cut down the borrowing. But when we look at some of the values and some of the quality that's been lost in that process, and we look at the current electricity prices being so high, then there are questions to be asked about how we manage public assets and what should be our policy in this area. And I noticed the quality policies that you have, so would you like to talk about them?
Well, I think you're right. Electricity sector is a classic example of short-termism and actually not getting societal outcomes that we want. Many of your listeners will remember when we had a different system of producing and selling electricity, we had incredibly affordable electricity. In fact, it was one of our economic superpowers that helped the development of, you know, timber mills and paper mills and all sorts of different economic jobs that grew on the back of it. Ever since we split it up into a system that no one else in the world runs, splitting up the generators and splitting up the electricity system into gentailers, which are integrated generator retailers, and then partially privatising all of some of them and most and almost most of the others, we've got really perverse outcomes. Power bills have risen 12% in the last year alone. That was before the fuel crisis. That's much faster than inflation. And the problem is that we're running an electricity system whose primary focus is delivering a profit rather than seeing it as a strategic sector that unleashes all the other economic activities and public goods that are required. You can see it in multiple other sectors. We're seeing increasing privatisation of our public health system. We are reliant on privatised early childhood and many retirement homes. And we're asking the question, should some of these public assets be brought back into public ownership and should they be run for the public good? We saw a massive change from the 1980s when we started selling off the state-owned assets. And when you look at the long-run returns and the progress, actually, we're collectively worse off as a result.
Yes, well, there's some very big examples of failure in the Ministry of ex-Ministry of Works area, like public highways, like the transmission gully, the cost of having to redo the project before it was even finished, and knowing that that redo is not going to last very long and is going to be a need for a whole new highway before too long. And all the cost of that is absolutely astronomical. But if we had kept something of the original values and the quality that was able to be delivered through the Ministry of Works, we would be much better off.
Well, that's right. The Independent Infrastructure Commission recently published a report showing we actually spend amongst some of the highest amounts of our overall economy size on infrastructure. Mm. So we spend an awful lot, but we get some of the lowest bang for buck in the OECD or the developed world. What this says is we're spending a lot, but we're not getting much for it. And we're seeing the breakdown in our infrastructure, be it water pipes, be it our transport networks, etc. So we actually need to be asking ourselves, how can we get better value for money? Mariana Mazzucato is a world-leading economist who is leading the charge in trying to bring back expertise and capability to the public sector. There are some things that can only be done by governments, and at the moment we're outsourcing it to private consultancies or private firms who, you're right, cost a huge amount of money, and we're not sure if we're actually getting good quality long-term assets as a result. So asset sales, no doubt, will be a conversation in this election, and we're urging the country to think, well, how can we actually bring back some capabilities and actually deliver things cheaper by doing it at the appropriate government level, be it local government or central government?
Yes, now in the document, The Blueprint for Prosperity, which your organisation has put out, you do mention some case studies of note, Wales, Scotland and Alberta. And I'm just wondering if there are some examples from foreign parts that might be useful to us in our thinking around the sorts of change and direction we need to go in.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty grim time internationally and economically in New Zealand. So it was a privilege for me to be doing a bit of research from around the world to look at things that were working well that we could learn from here in New Zealand. I was in Wales last year to research their Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. They passed it in 2015, and they're world leaders. They've got the world's first Future Generations Commissioner, someone with real power in their system and a role with real teeth to advocate for the interests of public future generations. In New Zealand, we've polled, and more than 80% of New Zealanders want our parties to work together in the long-term interest. We know we've got a real long-term planning problem. We're not adequately addressing the challenges of the future, be it technology like AI or threats like climate change. So we need a bit of help, and the Welsh have done it really well the last decade. What I saw that worked exceptionally well is that it was Welsh citizens themselves, through a deep citizen engagement process, that picked the seven goals for the country, the measures of progress that the commissioner was responsible for. So I think there's a great example how we could think more longer term. That's being followed by Australia, by Scotland, the United Nations, the European Union. In Scotland, I learned about their community wealth building law. This is the first law in the world to embed community wealth building as a mandatory practice for local government, public government, and economic development. In Scotland, they had a really similar problem to us here in New Zealand. They were looking for people, big multinational corporations out of the country, to come and invest and, you know, redevelop town centres or build factories. They asked a different question, which was, what if we actually looked at our own strengths, our own local businesses, and tried to keep more money wealth circulating locally? So they ran a pilot with five regions. It was so successful, they've now unanimously passed this law to encourage the public, the NHS in Scotland, to be making sure when they're spending money on procurement. And here in New Zealand, we spend $50 billion a year buying products and services on behalf of the government. In Scotland, they're asking, well, how can we keep that money circulating locally? They're asking, how can we keep our land and assets working to encourage local businesses? There, they're making a drive for worker-owned cooperatives, so the profits also stay in the community. So those were a couple of really big examples that I saw that we've included in this Blueprint for Prosperity. We really wanted to draw on what's working overseas. We're pretty practical here in New Zealand, so we don't want to have pie-in-the-sky sort of stuff. We're sharing examples of things that are working in practice that we should be following.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I know when I was an elected representative on a local board in Auckland, one of our principal efforts was to change procurement at the local board level to ensure that wealth stayed within our community where we could, and to increase some local employment, and to ensure we got contracts that enabled youth to get work experience. And I think having that type of governance model that we employed, then it got noticed, and parts of Auckland Council began to copy what we were doing. So I did feel that we were on the right track, and I could see the benefits coming back to the community.
Yeah, you're right. A few years ago, we published a white paper introducing the concept in New Zealand, and we looked at what councils were doing, what across the country. There are five principles of community wealth building, and we found Auckland was using the most of those five principles. That's when you get into real positive feedback loop territory, where one thing builds on another, and you get higher paid jobs and more money staying locally. What really stuck out in my mind was spending a day with the mayor of Preston in the north of England. They're considered the flagship city for this in the world. And similar to where I live now in Wellington, which is they were hoping a multinational would fix the downtown with a major cinema redevelopment. They pulled out during the global financial crisis, so they had to do it themselves. But they made sure that people were, the apprentices were trained locally, that there was local businesses that were doing the work, being preferentially cooperative. And they've opened everything from nightclubs for the university students to camper van parks for traveller communities there, run as cooperatives to keep these assets running, but importantly, keep the profits staying in the community. So often we see money coming into community and then just flowing straight out. Where I'm from in Tairāwhiti, Gisborne, where I grew up, $800 million gets spent a year on social services, but often not in the most effective way. And they're calling for the ability to actually decide how that money is spent locally. To my mind, that's a really good principle of localism and devolution, that we should be making decisions closer to those affected communities. It was great at the last election to see parties like National and New Zealand First and ACT talk about policies around devolving powers to local communities, sharing revenue with them. We haven't seen progress on that this year, but that's, I think, a good policy opportunity for any party to pick up. Most Kiwis wouldn't know, but we've got one of the most centralised systems of government in the OECD. If you look at how much tax revenue is raised from income tax and GST and rates, the lion's share, almost more than any other country in the developed world, goes to central government over local government. That means they've got systemic funding challenges. They're super reliant on rates, which is reaching the limit. So that's a conversation we're also urging in our Blueprint for Prosperity Guide, is how can we find more sustainable funding models that are fairer? How can we devolve power to our towns and cities and regions?
Mm, indeed. And so that brings me to the state of individuals and the poverty levels that some families are experiencing. And it's at both ends of the scale, affecting the youth and young children and older adults. So the concept of a universal basic service model is in your blueprint, and I'm wondering if you can outline how you would see that working.
Yeah, absolutely. So at the moment, our economy is just not working to deliver well-being for people by design. When you look at the child poverty statistics, 4 in 10 kids in poverty in this country have a parent in full-time work. I just don't think that's right if you're working more than full-time in many cases and still can't pay the bills. So universal basic services is the idea that we can have high-quality public health, say dentistry, incomes that are based on livable standards. This is, I think, something we did much better in our past. We've increasingly seen more user pays, more privatised health, or other services, and it's almost like a two-tier system where some people can benefit from, say, private health insurance, but the public health system is worse as a result. Universal basic services is actually a cheaper way to deliver the overall services because you're not spending so much money on different programs, all the administration. It's a similar idea we have with our superannuation universal approach. It's so much cheaper as a percentage to our economy to be providing super the way we do rather than the much more complicated systems used overseas.
Yes, the complicated means testing that wealthy people can avoid through clever legal channels, and the result is that people caught in the middle who've got a little extra but not much extra actually pay the price.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
I've seen some of the impacts of it and the difficulties when people sell a family home in Australia. If they're Kiwis and they're getting the super over there, within 2 weeks they get a letter telling them your super is going to stop because you now have X figure in the bank, which was the value of their home, but they're still looking to replace that home and they're going to buy another one. But they're being warned they have a very small window to do that or they will cease to get the pension.
Yeah, this is another big question facing New Zealand is how do we pay for an ageing population where, you know, once it was seven workers for every person retired in this country, in a few decades' time, there'll be two people working for every retired person. We've got a really affordable system as a percentage of our overall economy at the moment. But the way that our tax system is made up, which is most of the tax comes from taxing work or taxing what we spend through GST. That means that particularly poorer and middle income families spend more of the overall tax spend because they can't afford spending money on food or transport or whatever it may be. We're a real outlier not having any form of uniform capital gains tax or wealth tax, which other countries have. So actually having a more fairer, balanced tax system is a key part of the affordability of these universal services or superannuation. That's something the Treasury, the IRD, have been talking about for many years. And we're part of the Tax Alliance, Better Tax Alliance here in New Zealand. And at the moment, we've got a pretty unfair system. When the IRD and Treasury looked at it a few years ago, our 211 wealthiest families with assets of $270 million each were paying tax rates effectively at half the rate of our nurses and our teachers. I just don't think that's right. And it's also not a sustainable way to fund essential services like superannuation.
Yes, when the top 10% are paying getting 9% as their taxation level and the bulk of people are paying 30%, it just doesn't make sense.
No, that's right. And also, when you look at the savings side of the coin, across the ditch in Australia, they've got $4 trillion in their national savings account through their KiwiSaver equivalent. One of the other ideas in our Blueprint for Prosperity policy guide, a big idea that we're asking our elected representative candidates to consider, was Kids KiwiSaver, getting them enrolled from birth and making incentives and support available so people can start saving from the youngest of age, which means when they're older, they've got, you know, the opportunity to potentially buy a house or open a business or have a much larger retirement savings account. We're decades behind Australia. They've got one of the largest retirement savings accounts in the world. And there's other advantages for them too, because that giant investment fund is investing in Australian businesses, growing Australian jobs. With our much smaller KiwiSaver investment fund, we can't do as much. So let's start saving earlier.
And it's a very good healthy habit for young people to get into, because they begin to understand the value of compound interest. And that, of course, is what they're winning across their lifespan, and they're in a much better position to be able to cope later, even if they don't have a high-powered financial base from within their family. They at least have got the beginnings of being on the rungs of the ladder.
Yes, that's right. And that figure you introduced this interview on was the very small number of New Zealanders who think future generations are going to be better off. It's a real indictment. It's a real break against history. For generations, we've all wanted our kids to be better off than ourselves, and that has been the case. Something is fundamentally broken when that virtuous cycle is breaking down. But obviously, it's not an accident, right? It's the result of deliberate policy decisions that we've made over decades to not invest in a smarter economy, to not have a fairer, more balanced tax system, to not be giving those good services, to be investing in housing speculation rather than productive enterprises that grow the jobs and the sustainable wealth. So, yeah, that's one of the biggest challenges this country has. How do we turn the ship around and make sure that future generations have brighter futures for the future?
Yeah, that's our biggest challenge overall. And Max Rushbrook has done his analysis, and is, as a political analyst as well as an economic theorist, I mean, his statistics show very clearly the intergenerational breakdown with Pacific Islanders, where the parents came here in the 50s, they could be sure that their offspring were going to benefit from the move, and their people would get educated. But now the people are locked into poverty, and the next generation is not likely to become homeowners. They're not likely to succeed, except if they're, unless they're the 1% at the very top and they get invested in by other people. Yeah, we have a few of those, but basically the majority are not going to do well.
No, and that's what I think we should all be able to agree on, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, and we're nonpartisan and entirely independent, but we should be able to agree that let's have a better future for young Kiwis growing up. I just think what a waste it is seeing people, you know, out of work, leaving New Zealand, young people not feeling confidence in the future or a sense of opportunity. Mm. What a waste of all that resource that could be building a better country. So that's exactly what we're doing, working with economists, working with partners, councils, and we're urging politicians to be asking some of these big questions. We haven't talked about my background, but I was a politician for a decade in Parliament, and what I saw there was a lot of ambulance at the bottom of the cliff thinking, a lot of short-termism, a lot of reacting to issues rather than thinking how we can solve them. A huge amount of money spent to respond to things we continue to break and we know we're going to break into the future. So I'm asking all politicians this election, let's think a bit bolder. Let's think a bit more long term. Let's actually look at what the system is delivering and what levers we can pull to bring back that opportunity for everyone in this country.
And thank you, Gareth, for your excellent unpacking of the Blueprint for Prosperity presented by We All. And I wish you well in promoting it, because I think we all need to consider these things closely. Thanks for listening, and we all hope to have you all with us next week.
Together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6, or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus, and do note Senior Focus is one word. Remember me.
was a true love of mine. Tell her to make me a cambric shirt, a deep forest green, parsley, sage, rosemary, and you.